Okay, thank you all. Promptly sitting and happy International Women's Day and welcome everybody. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Jenny Lyon and the past president of the Institute, and really happy to be here and having been asked to facilitate this session, because one of the things I talked a lot about last year when I was president was diversity and the value that it brings. And the more that I've thought about it and looked for the benefits of diversity, I guess I've realised how important it is, because despite the best will in the world and a genuine intent to think broadly and from different perspectives, we all come with such an individual frame of reference that it's only by bringing together a range of backgrounds and different perspectives into the room that we really can attempt to get some diversity of thinking. And those who can't acknowledge that that's the case, that they need to listen more to the views of others, I think really are kidding themselves, that they're able to come at it from all different perspectives. The privilege that most of us in this room share put us in a very different position from many other people around the globe. Today we're going to talk about gender diversity, not diversity more broadly, because it's International Women's Day and because it's important. But I'd like to recognise that, as I say, many of us here are very privileged. And we also need to think about the feminist battles that are being fought and have yet to be fought overseas in countries where women, and also many men, are much less lucky than we are in Australia. For it, just as an example, it was September 2017 when it was announced that women have been granted the right to drive in Saudi Arabia. So women no longer need permission from a legal guardian to get a license and will not need a guardian in the car when they drive. I know how freed up I was when my children began to drive, so I can't imagine what it's like to be a woman who's now able to drive in Saudi Arabia. So there's still a long way to go in many countries. Just very briefly, from my perspective, where do I come on this? I think I grew up inspired by the stories of the suffragettes. My general studies teacher commented on an essay that I wrote that he was expecting to see me handcuffed to the school gates. I went to University of Warwick, which was where Germaine Greer had been an academic. And when I've reflected to my children on why I became an actuary, I realised that many of my decisions around studying maths and science and then wanting to work in business, rather than specifically targeting the actuarial career, were influenced by a desire to work in areas where women had not worked traditionally. So while I don't think many people would describe me as a revolutionary, there is a part of me that's always been driven by wanting to demonstrate that women have the right to have a seat at the table in all walks of life. And that's why it's important to me that we're all here today having this conversation. In Australia today, there's a lot of talk about how we encourage more women to move into maths and science-related roles, and particularly getting them to study that at school. And I think as a profession which embraces the value of complex thinking and applying mathematical modelling, we have a duty to ensure that we're supporting women who enter the profession and ensuring that they have equal career opportunities both now and into the future. Council's focus has been very much on what the profession needs to do now to ensure success for the future, and part of that is making sure we're relevant to the society we'll serve, and diversity is so common in our community. I think we need to think about that. So we established the Diversity Committee last year as part of that initiative, and they have organised today, for which I thank them. And I'm going to stop there talking about me, because we've got four really interesting people to speak, and I know that there will be lots of questions coming, because I already have a list before we've even started thinking about it. So I'm going to introduce them. We're going to have four speakers, and I'm just going to introduce them all now, and then they can come up and speak at the relevant time. So we have Adam Butt, who's an associate professor at the ANU, and the accreditation actuary also at ANU. He is a designer and instructor of a free online course called Introduction to Actuarial Science, which is designed to provide students who are considering an actuarial career with an interactive introduction to the profession. And Adam's going to talk to us about insights and trends regarding female students who are enrolling in actuarial studies and how we might attract more female students. Then we have Alice Huang, who's a principal at Finity and has worked in general insurance since 2006 and qualified as a fellow in 2008. She's got a keen interest in data analytics and leads the SME pricing and analytics practice at Finity, having worked on numerous pricing assignments for a range of different organisations in the insurance industry, as well as developing new products. And Alice is going to talk to us about the benefits of gender diversity and working in gender diverse teams. Jennifer Lang is CFO and Chief Actuary at Commonsure, and many of you may know she's the author of a popular actuarial blog, actuarialeye.com, and she says the views are her own and don't reflect the views of her employer, which I probably need to say, but it is a well worth reading blog. She always has an interesting point of view, often about gender, and she's going to talk about women as leaders. And then we have Michael Rice, who's the CEO of Rice Warner. And he specialises in providing strategic advice to financial institutions, fund managers, government agencies, industry associations, and large superannuation funds. And he is also heads up our Public Policy Council Committee. He's the current, I suppose, the 2017 Actuary of the Year for the Institute, has a range of other roles, and is very knowledgeable about superannuation and pensions, and in particular is going to talk about male champions and how they can promote gender diversity within organisations. So I'll welcome Adam up first. Thank you.
Okay. This is what we need, I think. Yes. But don't press that. Oh, here we go. Thanks, Liz. It's a dangerous thing to do. I'm going to start with an anecdote. I'm going to show you some graphs and numbers in a moment, but I'm going to start with an anecdote. Oh, I teach a final semester course for actuarial students at the ANU. It involves a significant amount of group work, which is pretty scary for actuarial students, group work. And furthermore, to make it more scary, I randomly allocate the groups. In the past, it's been pretty much completely random. I make sure there's equal number of international and domestic students, but not a huge amount of stratification apart from that. This has worked okay. I mean, the aim for doing that is to put students out of their comfort zone rather than just working with their friends. It's worked okay, but there certainly have been instances where groups have not really worked as effectively as they could together, and unfortunately, even worse than that in some instances in terms of harassment and such things. Last year I tried something. I said, I'm going to make sure every single group, the groups of five students, I'm going to make sure every single group has at least two female students in the group. And we're lucky enough, there's enough women in the class that I could make that happen. So every group of five had either two or three women, therefore two or three men. It worked spectacularly well. It was the absolute most, the calmest course I have ever taught, pretty much, in terms of me having to deal with group issues. The groups went off and did their thing. They worked spectacularly well together. They produced amazing actuarial reports as part of this exercise. And that was the only change I made to the group allocation process, was just making sure every group had two or three women in it. Now, that's an anecdote, I know, but I think it's pretty strong evidence of the value of diversity in teams. I've been very blessed to have strong female role models at university and in my corporate working life who are actually here today, which is a little bit scary, but I think there's plenty of evidence there to suggest that the gender diversity is vitally, vitally important. Okay, you can see this is good. It looks a little weird on the screen, but that's not a problem. Here's some numbers. So in order to talk about enrolment in universities, we have to start at year 12. Because that is a very, very big driver of who might enrol in an actuarial program. So this is a table that shows from 2006 to 2015 what the proportion of students, male and female, who enrolled in the highest level of mathematics in across Australia. Now, different states do different things. So if you look at sort of the averages here, it's probably about 10% if you combine males and females. That's because other states have, they don't have extension 2 maths like New South Wales has. Extension 2 maths, the numbers would be a fair bit lower. But you can see there very clearly a very big difference between males and females. Unfortunately, you can also see a downward trend as well. It's gone down from about 10.6% combined to about 9.6% combined. There is one unusual year there in 2014. WA did something weird with their courses. That's why you can see a little blip there for males. But if you combine these together and recalibrate it to the proportion of women in those math courses, it's a pretty consistent 35%. So 35% of enrollees in advanced mathematics courses are women. So that's where we're starting from. And this is driving very, very clearly what proportion of female students might enter the actuarial degree and then the actuarial profession. Now, there are a number of reasons for this. I did some research on this before the talk, got very, very lost because there is tons and tons of stuff out there. But there is a fairly strong consensus that socialization and stereotypes do have a very, very big influence in this space. Extension 2 math is not for girls, that sort of thing. Now, I would question the ability of the Institute to do much about that issue. That's an enormous, enormous issue, but we need to be aware of that in thinking about the next numbers that I'm going to show. I don't need to introduce my massive open online course because Jenny did that for me. Here's some numbers for the proportion of female enrollees in the course. Doesn't look hugely different to the numbers we were just looking at before. So about 3 out of every 10 students who enroll in that course are female. There's been over 40,000 people enroll in the course. So these are pretty robust numbers. So there's the background. Let's talk now about ANU. Now, I've actually been in discussions with Bernard Wong at UNSW and Leonie Tickle, who is somewhere. Where are you hiding, Leonie? There you are. About their experience at UNSW and Macquarie. And whilst we don't have data from them, anecdotally, they're seeing pretty consistent stuff to what I'm presenting here. So if you can't read those three legend titles up there, I've split this up into, this is a graph of the proportion of female enrollees in actuarial degrees at the ANU. So this on the y-axis is proportion of female enrollees across the last 10 years or so. I've split it up into undergraduate domestic, undergraduate international is blue, undergraduate domestic is orange, and postgraduate is green. Almost all postgraduates are international. That's why I didn't split that up. Let's look at domestic numbers first. So yes, there's a bit of noise in the data, but pretty consistently around 35% of our enrollees in undergraduate, in the domestic undergraduate space are women, which is very, very consistent with the 35% that I was talking about before for year 12. Where things get really interesting is in the international space, which is both the blue and the green lines. So again, there's a reasonable amount of noise in the data, but statistically speaking, it's pretty clear that it's around about 50-50 of international students are female, male, which is fascinating. And it really, really surprised me. When I did the group allocation I was telling you about before, I thought, great, we've got 45% of our students are women. This is going to be nice and easy to allocate all the groups evenly. It was because of our international cohort that I was able to do that. This number here is 70% women, which is amazing. And this is not a tiny number either. I think we had 38 international undergraduates enroll in 2017. So it's 27 to 11 women to men. It's not like it's 7 to 3 or something like that. So I found that really, really interesting when I was delving into this. And I did a little more research on other STEM areas in other countries. And I found that, for example, in Australia, 1 out of every 8 engineers are women. In China, 1 out of every 3 engineers are women, which is fascinating. I think it's really exciting that in the international space that we have got pretty close to equity in the gender space. That's enrollment. We also need to look at performance. So I'm going to show you two different versions of this. This is transfers out. So who's leaving the degree before finishing? There's lots and lots of noise here, so let's just ignore that. I've split this up into undergraduate and postgraduate, females and males. There wasn't any international domestic difference, so I didn't bother presenting that. Where the noise sort of disappears around about here, we can see it's around about 15 to 20% or so transfer out of the degree. They might transfer to an easier degree like accounting. This is being recorded, isn't it? Yeah. Or they might transfer to another university. We don't know the difference between those two. Now, if we're looking for differences between males and females, you won't really find anything here. There's a fair bit going on here, but if we look at just the green lines, which is postgraduate females and males, I mean, if anything, the male transfer out rate is a little higher than the female transfer out rate, but there's not really any statistical significance there. Males, similar sort of thing. Undergraduates, similar sort of thing. There's not really a difference between the blue constant and the blue dotted line there. If you're wondering why this is so low, they've only been around for a year. We haven't scared them with the hard actuarial courses yet. So that's why this is quite low here. Let's also look at performance as well. So we're going to measure this by GPA, grade point average. ANU does this in a really, really weird way, but 7 basically means high distinctions across the board, 6 is a distinction average, 5 is a credit average, 4 is a pass average. Now, before all of you who are interested in university education get up in arms and go, these lines are going up, standards are dropping. There are reasons for this going up that aren't standards dropping. It's probably important that I say them, actually. In the postgraduate space, we changed our exemption level for Part 2 courses from a credit to a distinction over this period, and so the grades went up accordingly, so the standards remain the same. In the undergraduate space, that's sort of going up as well. There's been an explosion in students doing double degrees over that 10-year period. This GPA is across their whole double degree. They find the accounting courses much easier than the actuarial courses, so that's why the numbers have gone up. Okay, that's not gender related. Let's get back to the gender stuff here. Okay, let's look at undergraduates. I can't really see a significant difference between males and females apart from this one year here, 2016, where males did perform. Well, this is people who enrolled in 2016, so not courses in 2016, this is the cohort. There is a difference here. I don't know why it is. I've tried to look into it and I haven't found any reason. But apart from that, it looks pretty consistent. At the postgraduate level, there is some evidence that males are performing better than females, although not a huge amount in later years. Back here, the cohorts were quite small at the postgraduate level, so I wouldn't read too much into that. If you're wondering why this is jumping up very, very quickly at the end, again, that's the first year. This is the 2017 cohort. They've done 1 year. They're just doing economics and finance courses, so that's why it's quite high to start with. So we're going with a trend here, aren't I? Okay, that's the ANU experience in terms of gender diversity. I think we need to also compare ourselves to other professions as well to see how we're going. So here's some numbers from other professions, which actually show that we're not doing too bad, to be honest. 17% of degree completions in IT are women. I'm focusing on STEM here, obviously. 15.6% of degree completions in engineering are from female graduates. As I already said, 1 in every 8 engineers in Australia are women. The Engineering Australia is currently going through a process of aiming to get 1 in 3 membership on committees in Engineering Australia. I think we can do a fair bit better than that. Now, that's the numbers. I'm going to offer a few thoughts now. I actually don't think we're doing that badly in terms of attracting women to the profession, given that we're starting from the 35% women doing the highest level of mathematics. And anecdotally, I have lots and lots of conversations with careers advisors from schools and female students who explain to me why they think the actuarial profession is attractive. We always have the most interest from the presentations we give in Canberra to schools are from the girls' schools, because the girls' schools tend to have at least 1 advanced mathematics class and they don't know what degree to do. They're a little intimidated by the idea of doing engineering for the reasons I've just mentioned, but actuarial studies, they probably don't even know what it is, to be honest. But when they hear about it, it's a perfect fit for what they might be interested in doing as a degree. And This extends even further into the employment space. Our female graduates at ANU, and I'm sure that the same is probably, it's probably the same for other universities as well, our female graduates are in enormous demand. Companies want to hire female graduates. I've even just last week, I had a conversation with an international student who just graduated. International students find it really hard to get jobs in Australia, find it really, really hard. She had two offers, and it's a good problem to have, isn't it, having two job offers. And she wanted to come and talk to me about what the best option for her was as an international student. I never have these conversations with our male graduates. It's the female graduates who get all the job offers because companies want to hire them, which I think is fantastic as well. That said, there is nothing wrong with us aiming to do better, to take more of these engineering students off engineering. And if we want to do that, in my opinion, the best way to do it is to target all-girls schools, because that is where there tends to be the biggest classes of advanced math students who may not even know what actuarial studies is. We've had the most success in Canberra targeting all-girls schools. Representation in everything that promotes the profession to society is vitally, vitally important. So, for example, in the Massive Open Online course, I made sure that we had 50-50 males, females for all the interviews I did during the course. And I was very lucky that I had such fantastic actuaries as Estelle Pearson and Trang Duncanson doing interviews for the course, which was awesome. But there's other ways we can present ourselves as well. So in the See What We See campaign, for example, I was playing around in that this morning. There's a section that has a number of videos of actuaries explaining what they do in fairly simplified terms. Now, there's seven videos there. Five of them have men speaking in them. Two of them have women speaking in them. That presents something to society as a whole about what the profession is aiming for. Furthermore, and this might be a little controversial, one of those two videos that has women has two women speaking. So it's 5-3 rather than 5-2 in terms of numbers. But is there a perception issue here? We've got one video where there's two people speaking. They're both female. Do you need two females to do the job of one man? I mean, we might laugh because we know it's not true, but what message is that sending to society who looks at these videos? Keeping these things front of mind is vital at all times. Perception is reality for most people. And that obviously then leads all the way through to HQ as well, to council. What we present to people who are looking at the Institute website is what they believe is true of the profession. That's about all I wanted to say. I'm going to pass on to Alice now.
Thanks. I hadn't actually realised I was next. I thought I was last. That's right. So, okay, well, I might skip. So my presentation is called Gender Diversity Matters, and it's really, I suppose I feel like I'm here today to really share my personal experiences about why it matters to me, why I think it's important, and hopefully, you know, I think the fact that you guys are all here means that you already are on board with this, but hopefully kind of help you be even firmer in your belief that it is an important topic and something worth taking action about. So I'm going to skip this a bit, but well, except to say I'm principal at Finergy. I've been working for about 12 years, always with the same company. And maybe skip to a bit more about my personal background. So I was born in China. I came to Australia when I was about 8.5. I grew up in Brisbane. I went to a girls' private school in Brisbane, actually. And then I came to Sydney to study actuarial. And I lived. I went to UNSW, lived in college as well. I was two colleges while I was there. And then I started working. And that's basically my life in a nutshell to date, plus other stuff, my working life, professional life. So I guess, well, what I wanted to say about my background was one thing I realised was very different. So when I started at college, I realised there was a big difference in maybe how I thought compared to the peers around me, especially women, I would say. And I realised that a big part of that was actually because I went to an all-girls school. So when we went to school, everything, you know, my school was the sort of school that encouraged women to be career women. The sort of things that teachers would say is, oh, Claire's going to be, Claire was our school captain, Claire's going to be the future Prime Minister of Australia one day. She's so good at debating. You know, those were the sort of comments that were made about us. It was, this person's going to go really far in life. She's so great. And it was almost a bit weird to, like, I think I remember 5 years after we all left school. No, actually, it was more than 5 years. 5 years after we started working, I got back in touch with some of my high school friends, and I was just, you know, gossiping about, oh, what's everyone doing these days, you know. And it was almost weird to actually hear about some women just actually started, you know, got married and had kids, and they never really got into the workforce very much. For us, from my school, from my background, that was not really something that we kind of thought about, at least not really something that I thought about, which is completely fine. But that was kind of where I started from. So then 2 years ago in 2016, one of the colleges I went to was in the news, like a lot of colleges recently, actually. They got in trouble over some pro-rape chants that were caught on camera, distributed over Facebook, and, you know, people found out about it. There was a whole lot of uproar, and they had to post this apology. I have to say, from what I experienced at college, things didn't seem this bad. So clearly, there's kind of been some ramping up of this sort of culture over the years. But looking back, I could definitely see that there were elements of this in college life. And at the time, I didn't think anything of it. I just thought, well, that's just kids being kids. I'm a kid. What's the harm in it? And, you know, I wanted to be cool. But I realized two things coming out of college. One is that actually that culture is not normal. And when you're immersed in that culture, you just sort of learn to accept it, become part of it. And it can take a lot to break out of that mentality. So you kind of gradually learn to suppress what you think is right, suppress anything that makes you feel or any feelings of discomfort, and then gradually you realize you don't actually know what's right anymore. And the second thing I realized is that, unfortunately, that sort of culture doesn't just exist in colleges. It follows some of these young men and women into the industries, the workplaces they get into, like financial services industry, some parts of the financial services industry more than others. So that kind of leads me on to my experiences at work. And I've called it the good, the bad, and the ugly. I'll start with bad, and I'll go on to the good, and then the ugly. And then I've also wanted to ask myself, when have I been part of that culture? Because we all contribute to culture. So the bad. There are various examples. I feel no workplace is perfect. My very first experience of gender issues was when I was just starting out. I remember I was working with the principal, stepping up into a more of a project management role and delegating to a new analyst. I think that was my second year there. Unfortunately, that analyst, male analyst, wasn't particularly interested in actuarial and, you know, meant that I was having to stay late doing his work to make sure we met deadlines. So I went to the principal in charge to explain the situation, hoping that he'd have a talk with this person and kind of, you know, maybe sort of get him to actually take his job a bit more seriously. Instead, what happened was that person turned to me and said, well, Alice, you're a nice looking girl. Why don't you just be nice to him and get him to do what you want? So I think it was that obviously really upset me at the time. And I think looking back, it was really good affinity that I never had to work with this person again. And I still never have. Another good example, I suppose. So, when I started work, I spent about the first 5 years working in appointed actuary work, so valuations, SCRs, so on and so forth, which I found really interesting. But after that amount of time, I found, well, you know, it's time for a new challenge. I was really interested in looking at pricing. It seemed very technical. I like technical things. Why not get into it? So they made opportunities for me to get into the pricing team. I changed teams, changed managers, so on and so forth, which was fantastic. But I realized when I got into it that something really made me not enjoy it very much. I don't know, I just didn't enjoy my time there. And I found it was hard to get into. Most of my workmates, 90% of them, were male. So I was always working with boys, which was fine, except I always felt like I was the odd one out. I never, you know, felt like it was almost hard to get them to open up and actually let me be part of the group sometimes. And I think it wasn't necessarily something that was intentional, but it was just, you know, it was kind of a boys' club, boys' culture. And I remember at the time I thought, and there was one particular project that stuck out in my mind where I worked on that project with another analyst who was, or another consultant, sorry, who was male. And I found that he just wouldn't listen to me, even though I was actually more senior than him on the project. So I was asking him to do things, and he had a different view, and he would just follow his view. And ultimately, it ended up being that we didn't actually have great outcomes for the project. We had to fix things, we had to stay late, we ran over budget, we, you know, had issues with delivering. And I had to get, so as a result of some of this, I actually had a lot of conversations with my manager, who was luckily, you know, senior enough at the firm that he, and also someone who was open enough to these topics that he actually, you know, took what I said seriously, made some changes, made sure that, you know, we tried to get more females into the pricing area, made sure that we tried to kind of shift things around and spoke to various people to make it work. So that was, I suppose that was a really good experience for me, because it showed me how supportive the firm was of having this diversity and of making it work for me. I guess I was worried at the time that, you know, perhaps, well, if I'm the only one having issues, maybe I should just be the one to leave this place or leave this particular team. So it was really good that they actually, you know, were committed to making that change, took time out of their day, spoke to people on the team, so on and so forth. The last thing that I wanted to talk about was, well, actually the second last thing, is some of the, I guess, what I call the ugly. I can't think of any personal experiences that I would put in that category. I have heard of things through friends and other people that I would place in that category. So, for example, I've heard of one company, banking and finance, that doesn't actually hire women, not as a, you know, explicit policy that they put on their HR sheets, but they wouldn't say it to, obviously, interviewees. They would not give interviews to women necessarily, but I heard it from the wife of one of the guys who works there, who also works at my company, actually. And the reason they did it was because they wanted to keep it a boys' club. They wanted to actually be able to do what they feel like without having to feel like they had to, you know, constrain themselves in front of women who may not necessarily buy into that culture. I've heard of some worse stories, but nothing that's kind of substantiated enough to bring up. And the last question I put there is, I suppose, when have I been part of that culture? Because, you know, it's, I'm sure all of us have examples where we feel like we've been wronged in the past, but as I said, when you're immersed in cultures like that, you actually end up, you kind of buy into it, and sometimes you don't even realise. A lot of times people don't realise that they're actually part of that culture, because that's the history of where we came from, that's what we grew up seeing, that's what we grew up believing, that's what we grew up being taught how the world is. So there was one memory that I had that kind of stuck out in my mind, because I felt really bad about it at the time. I was part of a group that was, we were hiring someone, hiring a new person for this role, and I was having discussions with HR about this. And I remember saying, oh, we really need someone, you know, we need them to be here, you know, full time, et cetera, et cetera. And we had a couple of different candidates. One of them was female, some of them were, and then others that were male. Actually, majority of people tend to be male. The female candidate was, there were kind of two people who were both qualified for the role. And I remember sort of thinking, well, you know, this woman's probably going to go off and have a child soon. So really, you know, are we really going to get what we want from this person? And I remember I said this to the HR lady, our HR lady at the time. And she immediately corrected me and said, well, we can't do that. That's not, first of all, that's not legal. But secondly, we really should be actually giving people equal opportunities. And That was quite a lesson for me, I suppose. I just really just thought about it from a very narrow-minded view of, okay, what about work hours? What are we going to get out of this person in terms of work hours? Are we getting exactly what we want? So that's kind of, yeah. I mean, I felt really bad about it at the time. It was a learning experience for me. I'm sure there are plenty of other examples where I've been part of that culture as well. And, you know, it's just kind of, it helped me be more aware of the times when I actually am the one who's perpetuating it. So the good thing is that the world is always changing and evolving, and we move forward quite quickly these days. And the gender diversity and equity movement has definitely picked up pace in the last few years from what I've observed just reading the news. So why is it so important that we make progress on gender diversity? So I think Jenny mentioned before, there's no doubt men and women think differently. They look at things from different angles. And these differences are really important. They help us tackle problems from more than just one angle, so we end up with a better solution than what one team would have been able to, or one set of people would have been able to come up with on their own. I think Karen Halliday put it really well. For our organisations to succeed, we need to harness our collective intelligence and approach problems with this cognitive diversity. It's no longer okay for workplaces to lack gender equity. It's not fair, it's not smart. And there's plenty of evidence to support it. McKinsey's reports show that gender diverse companies are 15% more likely to outperform their peers, and ethically diverse companies are 35% more likely to do the same. I think it was a Credit Suisse report in 2014 that identified a positive correlation between the level of female representation on boards and senior management and improved financial and share market performance. I'm sure none of this is particularly new to most of you here. But I think, you know, if I bring it back to sort of our perspective, it's important to all of us because it affects all of us, even though it may not look like that on a day-to-day basis, even though it might mean that on a day-to-day basis, some things actually seem harder because you have to talk that much more and get on the same page that much more. But in the long run, if we can put the best people in the best roles, in the right roles, sorry, it means that our companies, our teams, and ourselves, we have a better chance of succeeding. It also means that I think both men and women can have a more balanced and happier life. So, you know, if I think about my peers and the people that I grew up with, the people that I went to uni with, the people I'm working with, I don't think that men just want to focus single-handedly on their careers. I'm sure some men do, but I doubt that you could say the majority of men do. I look at my father and his generation, and I think they kind of really missed out on certain aspects of life. You know, he's getting to the end of his career, and that's kind of the main thing he has to show for his life. And really, that was because he had all this kind of pressure on himself. He thought he had to be the only breadwinner. He had to be the main breadwinner. He had to be, you know, that was his focus. And I also think women can't do it on their own, or any other minority for that matter, can't do it on their own because we're starting on the outside. They're starting on the outside. So it really takes people on the inside to be part of that movement and to let them in. So my last slide, what can we all do? So these are my views. By no means are they complete, and you know, I'm very open to other people's thoughts on what can be done. But I think from the employer's perspective, and I do see a lot of employers doing this in the financial services industry, which is where I work, obviously. But a lot of employers are now consciously thinking about what does gender equity look like to us? What does gender diversity look like to us? How do we actually actively support women to contribute to our organisations, to be part of our organisations, and how can we leverage the expertise and a different style of thinking they bring? So I think it's really important that gets communicated, that gets kind of people or the employees in the organisation come on board with that, and there is a concrete plan for how you actually get there. You know, I hear a lot of my friends in banking talk about, well, they have to hire someone, but it has to be a woman, which can lead to some short-term frustrations, but I think in the long term, I think they'll agree that it's a good thing. I think for the Institute, this education awareness, promoting dialogue, kind of making people aware of it, not making it such a taboo topic. When I felt like I had issues, I really thought, well, I can't raise this. I have to be very careful how I raise this. It was lucky that I had a really good relationship with my manager that I felt like I could raise it without feeling like I'm going to be seen as complaining or whistleblowing or whatever the case might be. Not whistleblowing, complaining. And I think, you know, kind of leading by example and maybe thinking about what guidance and support we can provide our members in this topic. It's a difficult topic to deal with sometimes. It's definitely different from numbers. It's not a case of necessarily 1 + 1 = 2. There's a lot of grey areas there. But I think the most important thing is from each of our perspectives, if we actually want to change culture, it comes down to us. It comes down to what we do, how we think, what we say, how we talk to people. And I think it would be nice if the actuarial profession was kind of viewed as one of those professions where we really do have diversity, we really do have equality, and we do have what's the word I'm looking for? I had it on the previous slide. Meritocracy, that's it. So, yeah, and I think that's really comes down to just being really conscious of what biases we have in our own thinking and making sure that we actually question our own behaviours as well as call out behaviours that we see around us that maybe isn't acceptable, and kind of giving support to those who might be on the other side of those behaviours. And of course, there's also being part of people, the group that instigates change, so having this kind of diversity committee and diversity panel and really kind of making sure that people are aware of this and kind of talking about this topic with others. So that's pretty much all I had today. I'm going to hand it over to Jennifer. Oops.
Just thought I should put my hand up there just to make sure it was the right person. So yes, it's me, Jennifer Lang. So I'm talking a little bit about the next stage. You've heard from Adam about how do we get people into the profession, but how do we actually make sure that we continue with that, and how do we get people as leaders? But I thought I'd start by going to the past. Where have we come from? Now, I was going to start by talking about myself, but I actually got a great story during the week from someone who can't be here who gave me permission to share this with you. About her experience of starting in the profession 40 years ago. So she said, I was encouraged to study maths and science at high school, but there was no career counselling, so I didn't know what to do next. I wanted to be a maths teacher. Many people I know in the profession have started out thinking I want to be a maths teacher because I didn't know what else you could do with being good at maths. But there were no government scholarships, so I couldn't afford to go to school, to university. So she started working in a life insurance company's claims department and calculated surrender values. I think I used to know that as a special calcs team. Many people know that team. And then I discovered the actuarial profession, but I was discouraged from studying by the branch actuary as I was a woman. I started studying at Macquarie as an independent student, but I was only one of four females in a class of 40. And thankfully, after my first year at Macquarie, I was offered a scholarship that led to employment with a company that supported study and rewarded exam success with salary increases and promotion. After gaining my fellowship, I've enjoyed a long career as a consultant, full-time and part-time, to balance my family's needs. So that's a great story of how someone managed to get into the profession and became a leader in the profession. But it just shows that although it's still hard to get gender diversity in the profession, it was a lot harder in the old days. So I remember when I was going to around the different companies for actuarial scholarships, I was asked at the age of 17 what my plans for family were and when I was going to get pregnant, which at the age of 17 I didn't know the answer to that. So oddly enough. We have come a long way, but what I guess we've got a lot of women in the profession. Are we actually making the most of the talents that we have in the profession and promoting the people who are capable to the leadership roles? Now, Jenny mentioned that I've got a blog, and every now and again I have a bit of fun with some statistics. So I had a look at the census when it came out and just looked at the census has quite a lot of granular data about, among other things, income. So this is self-reported. It's people who report themselves as actuaries or mathematical scientists, I think it was. It's not just actuaries, but close. And what they've self-reported as their pay. And what you can see from this is that we do have a higher proportion of women at the higher pay ranges in 2016 than we did in 2011. But we've still got, there's still a much greater proportion of men at the higher pay. So there's still that point where at the really well-paid roles, we've got a much higher proportion of men. So we're getting women into the profession. We've got that 35%, but are they actually going all the way through? Now, many people I talk to will say, well, that's choices. People have chosen to go part-time. Julie, who gave me that story, did choose to go part-time. So it's okay. There's no discrimination. It's just people's choices. But I don't believe that. I think some of it is people's choices, but some of it is also about the environment that we are in and how people choose to promote people and how people choose people to give the best opportunities to. So I guess, how do we get women as leaders and how can women as leaders help to change that? So I haven't got there very many other points on this slide, and I'd love to talk about it more in the panel discussion, but my kind of, does it work? Yes, it does. On my screen here, it doesn't work, so I have to look around me. So what can we do as leaders? First of all, I think Alice talked about unconscious bias. We all have unconscious biases, so we need to be aware of that. So there's been some really interesting studies in the science field in the US of people, how do men and women give references in the academic field? And you'll find that both men and women will give different references to men than they give to women. So women are biased as well. We all live in this society. It's not just that you know, men are biased and women are not. It's, we all live in a society and we have a view about what is the kind of picture of a leader or the picture of a successful person. So it's important to be aware of that. It's not just a male-female thing. I'll give an anecdote. We were having a performance round table in one of my teams quite a long time ago. We were talking about two people who were both very good. One was really, in my view, one was really good at marketing. One was really good with people. And they were actually the wrong way around for their gender stereotype. So the one that was really good at marketing was the woman. The one that was really good with people was the man. And there were a lot of people in the room, men and women, who kind of just went to the gender stereotype and said, this one's really good with people. And I go, really? She's actually, you know, she's really struggling to work with the graduates, but look at her out marketing. She's fantastic. So we all have stereotypes, and it's important to think about people's behaviours and what they do rather than what you expect them to do. I guess the next point is quite related to this, is performance management systems, really making sure that when we do have a performance management system, we think very carefully about what we're looking for and the behaviours we're looking for, the skills we're looking for, and look at those skills, not our preconceived notions. So that's a little bit about saying this is the thing that we want you to do, this is the behaviour we want you to display, making sure that we're looking at people as what they actually do and not what we think that they're doing. And that comes back to very specific role requirements. So one of the things that I've read a lot about how people are appointed to boards, people tended to be appointed to boards in the past by someone who I think would be good on my board. But if you actually look at what are the skills I need for this board I need some marketing skills, this board I need some IT skills, this board I need some financial skills, you automatically diversify the kind of people you think about. So that's similar in the roles you're looking at. You need to look at what are the skills I need for this role, not who was doing this role last, I'll appoint someone exactly the same as that person. So I can see all the recruiters in the room nodding sagely at that. So I think it's really important to really think carefully about what do you want in the role, the specific skills and requirements you need, rather than I know someone who was good at that over there, so therefore I'll appoint someone who looks like that. So it's hard because you tend to assume that someone you've seen be successful, you need to replicate that person, you need a clone of that person. But that's actually not what's made them successful, it's their skills and experience that's made them successful. So I guess that those kinds of things build a fairer workplace for everyone. One of the things I think of gender diversity as a little bit the canary in the coal mine. It's the easiest thing to measure. But what we're really after is diversity of a workforce. We're looking at diversity across all sorts of different ways of measuring. But the easiest thing to measure, because pretty much every single statistic you'll find has a gender measure in it, you can find gender diversity. So if you aren't able to hire gender diversity, what on earth makes you think you can hire any other diversity? So you're hiring people who are the same as you, you're promoting people who are the same as you. But if you can manage gender diversity, you've got a fighting chance of managing other diversities, which are harder to measure. Doesn't mean you'll make it. You know, we've all seen, yeah, there are places where you have people who are all from the same background, but at least they're gender diverse, but at least you've got a chance because you're having to think through how to look at people who are different. So very happy to talk more in the panel discussion about some of that, but now I'm going to hand over to Michael.
Thank you, and it's good to see such a good attendance here today, including a couple of people from Rice Warner, so they might be wondering what I'm going to talk about. We do a lot of research in our business, and for many years we've looked at retirement adequacy, and we've done that geographically, we've done it by gender, and so we've had quite a few statistics that have shown that women generally don't retire as comfortably as men. Now, 70% of people are married at the time they retire, so you can argue there's a bit of averaging out. But we also know that the biggest poverty group in Australia are single women on the age pension living in rental accommodation. And that's quite a large number of elderly people. So we know that as a society, we haven't really addressed all the problems. So I'll quickly run through and show you why the problems exist. So if you look at the typical bloke, he has quite an established career, and when he gets married, he doesn't interrupt his career as a rule, and earns more and often works longer hours too, or retires a bit later than a female. So when you then look at the female position, they earn less than men. They tend to retire earlier, 3 years earlier than men as well, and that could be the fact that that's the typical gap between a married couple, and perhaps they retire at the same time. But a lot of women do retire earlier, even when they're single. So, and that broken pattern is quite commonplace. So it's apart from some wealthy, you know, the top decile professional women, it's the gap is quite common throughout. So we thought to ourselves, what are the solutions to this? And we've put in a lot of government submissions. There was a big Senate inquiry in 2016, which looked at retirement adequacy for females in retirement. Heading of that final report was, I think, "A Man Is Not a Plan." But it's well worth looking at, because the Parliamentary Joint Committee, or it's the Economic References Committee, because it had a lot of submissions, including one from us, and it looks at all of the issues and potential solutions, none of which the government has yet addressed 2 years on. So, but we, as we did this research, some of the people within our business started questioning, you know, what can be done, and we thought we would be hypocritical if we didn't look at playing our own part, even in a small way. And we're a small, medium business. We've probably got close to 70 people if you add up all the casuals and contractors and various people in the business. So, we're not one of the banks. And so what we do is not going to make a material difference. But we thought if we did nothing, we'd be hypocritical writing all these submissions, telling everyone else what to do. And the solution really is one that needs to be addressed by individuals. So females themselves should think of their circumstances and perhaps plan. Employers, government, and society. Every community has a role to play. And so we thought we would start by paying additional superannuation contributions to our female staff, and then found that was actually in breach of the Sex Discrimination Act. So we went to the Human Rights Commission, and it took us 2 years to get a ruling, but eventually the argument we used was that we really should be measuring outcomes and not costs. So if we had insurance for staff, which we pay for generally, the male premiums are higher than the females, so the cost of the business is higher, but we're actually looking at the same outcome, the same amount of insurance, irrespective of gender. So if we wanted people to have the same retirement outcome, then we should accept that the costs of achieving that might be different. And if women, for example, live 3 years longer than men, at the time we thought that was about a 1.5% of salary difference. So you can't close the gap completely, but we thought, and you can't target either. We've got some very successful women of all ages who will be financially adequate in retirement. But, we don't know in advance who they'll be, so you have to treat everybody the same. And so as part of our package, we decided that we would pay an extra 2%. We circulated it amongst all the staff, had one male who asked lots of questions. He wasn't really anti, but he was curious, but then he was with everything he did, so we didn't take this to be particularly different. And then we ended up with a package. And the package basically is to, that's the process we went through. And by the way, the Human Rights Commission called for public submissions, and Women in Super Group, we'd actually do all their modelling. They put something in. And some of the state-based sex discrimination commissioners and a couple of individuals, but there was nothing from the superannuation industry. So all these industry groups, big funds, that frankly pontificate about all these things, none of, even though some of them were singled out, we wrote to some and asked if they would put in a submission. Many of them did nothing, and we thought that was significant apathy in our industry, which was a bit disappointing. But what we do is we it's not just the 2%, and by the way, the in our business we pay the SG and nothing above that, because we value super and salary as a package together, and we don't believe that we should force people to put more in super if they prefer to save for a mortgage or something else earlier in life. But the 2% that goes to the female staff is earmarked as part of the employee benefits package. So it's not in the HR salary package. It's just treated as a separate benefit that's actually paid separately to the normal super. And we built in other things too, like paid parental leave. We even count parental leave towards long service leave. So we've done a bit of tweaking. And of the females, I think 20% actually pay more themselves in addition, because every 6 months we have a staff, or the female staff have an educational session which sets out what we do and what we're trying to achieve. So we think it's been quite valuable internally. Certainly, recruiting in the last 4 years, we seem to get more females applying. It's only anecdotal, and as I say, we're small, so I don't really know the numbers. But I think it's generally been well accepted. We're disappointed it hasn't been copied widely. Unions New South Wales copied us, and they do the same 2%. ANZ, I think, pay $500 for every female earning less than 70 grand. But to my knowledge, no one else has copied us. A part of the reason for that is that you can't just do it. You've got to, there's no carve out. So one of the things we've tried to lobby government is to say, let employers pay more without needing to apply for an exemption from the Sex Discrimination Act. You'd think that it would be a blanket exemption, but they treat each case separately. So I'm going to leave you to Q&A with my other panelists, but I'd just like to say that, you know, we'd welcome anyone else copying us.
Thank you, everybody. So that was a really wide range of different presentations, and covered a huge amount of ground. So I'm sure there are lots of questions. I'm going to just ask everybody one question, and then I want to open it up to the floor. And I guess what I'm interested in is practical things that each of you have seen as being effective in increasing diversity. Michael's is easy, perhaps, because he's already done it, but just increasing diversity within your organisations. You got any practical ideas? Michael, anything else?
Well, we can only go on our own experience, yep. But and anecdotally, I think it's been beneficial. Mm.
How's that better? we've got a good balance in our business. I think we're so our board, our executive management team are all about 50-50 male female, and that hasn't been by trying to fill a quota. Just happen naturally, and even the graduates coming in are the same sort of balance.
Okay. So, I did have a practical question actually. Is your parental leave and your education program also available to men?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Because yep. I think it's important that it's seen as equally available. I know that you're giving a higher level of superannuation, but I still think it's important that education is available, particularly that you're providing.
So we've got it set up as primary and secondary carer.
Sure.
But and obviously the women are usually the primary carer, but not necessarily today.
No. Thanks. Jennifer?
And in fact, I have one of my team on primary care, one of male member of my team on primary care parental leave right now. So yes, it does. It's both, which is really nice. I think the one thing, if I was picking one thing, I would say forcing people to have both men and women on shortlists, because it doesn't mean that you necessarily hire that person, but it forces you to think widely about the possible candidates and why haven't I got a woman? What is it about my requirements that is meaning I'm not having a woman or a man sometimes, depending on the role? So that would be my one thing.
Thanks. Yep.
I'm going to say quotas, not because I like it, because I have to say I wasn't very supportive of it when I first heard the idea, but it works. It's effective. When you start having more women in positions of power, making decisions, I guess, you know, it means that they can actually do more to help new people come through. You forcibly change the culture, because otherwise, you know, let's say you're starting off with 70% male, 30% female, it's hard. It's hard to kind of make them really say, oh, but I don't know. I don't see many other ways other than quotas.
Okay, thanks. Adam.
Alice stole my answer. I think my group work course was an example of quotas, yeah. And I think it worked very well.
Okay, great. Okay, I'm going to open it up to the floor and also to the webinar, and I apologise for not having said hello to everybody who's on the webinar. So if you have questions, I have plenty more if you don't, but I'd like to open up.
Margaret Bishop, I'm from BNP Paribas. I'm very lucky to be a part-time worker with a challenging role. And what I probably don't necessarily have a question as such, but some comments about keeping women in the workforce. So I actually think that we're at the moment handling getting women into the workforce quite well. Through quotas and so on. I have two daughters, both in high school. For the older one particularly, the opportunities out there for her to be a successful female in particularly STEM, which is her area, I'm so glad she's not male, really. But what I would say is I don't think we're doing that well so far at keeping women in the workforce. And I would like this to be a conversation about just keeping older people in the workforce, because I would like to see that men are facing this issue, and I know some of them are, but on the whole it is women who choose to stay home with their families still. So many of them would like to go back to work and continue their career, and it's difficult. When I came back, I was lucky. I knew people in the industry. I came back and I said 9 to 5, 3 days a week, and that's it, take it or leave it. And they took me. So I'm forever grateful for that, and I'm still at the same place. One of the reasons I am still there is because whenever I go and look for what job opportunities are out there, it always comes up to me, there is nothing that you know, nothing advertised for you part-time. It's all full-time. So I would say that it's difficult to get a part-time job. It's difficult to change in a part-time job. It's difficult to, therefore, develop in a part-time role. And I think we could do a lot of work in that area to change that, because I don't think it needs to be that hard. The other thing I would like to say is that I think we need to also start recognising that the career path of a woman, let's say, someone who chooses to drop back for a while and then continue on, it's not the same as someone who works full-time all their life, you know. I used to get told things like, well, if you haven't made it by 35 or 40, then that's it, you're not going to. That's not going to work for a woman. You know, most of us have had children by early 30s and have taken time out. Most of us want to spend more time with our families, and then most of us, or a lot of us, come to later life and are ready to take off again. And I think we need to recognise that those people are bringing a lot. They're bringing a hell of a lot of life experience, often work experience, and should not be, I mean, this is getting into age bias, but we need to open our minds to the fact that women's roles or people who take part-time work, it's not the same career path as others. So if anyone would like to share,
would anybody like to comment on that?
I mean, broadly, I'd like to agree with it. One of the examples I'd love to talk about is when I hired someone to. So I've got a combined life and general insurance team. I hired someone to be my appointed actuary for general insurance for the first time in-house rather than externally, and she was 3 days a week. And when we had the interview, she was one of the reasons she was really happy to talk to me is because I was willing to listen to that rather than to say, can't you make it 4 days? But one of the things she said to me, which I thought was fantastic, is you can always predict when month end's going to be. It's amazing. So in a corporate life, month end is the rhythm. So she knew 12 months ahead, well, actually further, but obviously 12 months weren't enough, so that those 3 months a year, she had to change her childcare so she could be there on working day three, which is the biggest day of the month. But I went to other meetings around the organisation, and people say, you can't possibly ever have someone part-time who's working in a month-end position. And I'd tell that story, and you go, it's not that hard. But I think it is hard, and it requires imagination. It comes to what I was saying before about being really clear about what you need in the role and what skills you need rather than what person you need. So start with the skills before you get to the person. Sorry.
Melinda, thanks.
Yeah, hi, Melinda Howes. I work for Westpac, and Westpac's kind of got a fair bit of press around the fact that we've got a quota in place. We actually reached 50% women in leadership this year across a 40,000 person organisation, which is a big achievement from where we started. But what I don't think gets a lot of publicity is everything that went in around that to make that happen and how broad the diversity policies are in Westpac, which I think has been quite successful in changing the culture, although we've still got a long way to go. So not only is there a quota, but we had that same sort of thing. You have to have some women on your shortlist. You have to have a woman on your interviewing panel for every role. Yep. Every role is flexible. So Westpac might be a good idea. You cannot have a role that is only full-time. Every role is flexible, and that's been a recent one, and there was a lot of resistance to that. Every role is flexible, it's just been mandated. So, you know, these are quite radical policies. We are now, the next thing we're tackling, having ticked off gender diversity, although we haven't got it perfect, right? The HR team's still 95% women. There's no gender diversity in that team. They need more men. We're having trouble attracting women into technology roles and investment roles and institutional banking roles. We need more women there. So we're still working on this, and areas have targets based on their proportion and how do they change their proportion to get it closer to 50%. So it's a little more sophisticated than just a hard target. But the other thing that's been really means that we've attracted a lot of talent is we have a very open and supportive LGBTI community within Westpac. We have very senior leaders who are openly gay, including one member of Brian Hartz's executive team. And so we actually attract fantastic talent because we're known as an inclusive and diverse workplace across a whole range of factors. The one that we're working on now, which is still challenging for us, is cultural diversity. And it's harder for us to measure because people are less willing to self-report being in various cultural groups. So it's really hard for us to get stats on, but that's the next thing we're tackling. It's not easy, but yeah. we've got to decide to do it.
Yeah, okay. Warwick, thank you.
Warwick Hearn, I'd just like to comment on two directions in terms of how do we get change. And what I'd like to say is gender diversity for me is the Trojan horse for the rest of diversity. So I think therefore gender diversity is great because it helps all the rest happen as well, and I'm a firm believer in diversity. The other thing is that I think diversity itself is fundamentally excellent. You see it at Bunnings, for example, where there are a whole host of relatively old guys who are now giving back, and I think they'll work till they're 85 because they're still good at doing that stuff. The other thing I'd like to say is talking about part-time versus full-time, and we have more part-time workers in our small organisation than full-time. And my measure is that I get much more productivity out of a part-time worker for several reasons. One, they do all that other stuff on their time, not on my time, you know, and so all those other things we all have to do, you know, that gets done at some other time. And the other thing is they really value the fact that we're flexible and will allow them to do this, and they protect that with really good performance. So I think if our target is seen as outstanding performance, then for me, diversity is a given, and we should be using both those measures of diversity to help get more gender diversity and gender diversity to get more of that diversity.
Okay. Does anybody want to comment? I have another question from a webinar, actually. So this is from Kirsten Armstrong, who presented yesterday with another woman here about actuaries who trailblaze into wider fields. And someone in the audience asked whether it was just women who trailblaze. And then afterwards she thought, well, if two men had presented, would that question have come up? Or was it just that we're just so unused to seeing two women present together, then it seems a bit of a novelty? I don't know if anybody was here or whether you have any thoughts on that. No? Okay. Well, that's all right. I think the answer is unknown. All right, Louise, because you've got the microphone, but I would like to go to a male in a moment. Oh, you have a microphone. Sorry, I'll let Louise go first. Yeah, I promise we'll come back to you. Sorry.
I was going to say I'd like to thank and congratulate all the males for coming along today. And I think that is one of our challenges, is how do we extend these discussions so it's not mainly women talking about gender diversity, and how do we get more males involved?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. And Warwick, I do know you're male, sorry.
So I have a question for the panel, and it just came out of that the point that Alice and Adam made about quotas. So one of the things that supposedly, and I only know about it secondhand, but it's an increasingly documented phenomenon, is this thing of the glass cliff as opposed to the glass ceiling. And I think there's been some studies done in the States around board level and CEO level appointments of women into organisations, but in a lot of cases it's almost like they've been set up to fail because boards have always made decisions in a risk-averse way, so they sort of keep selecting men and keep selecting men, and then when things are really looking bad and they realise, oh, they need to change something up and they can take a few risks, they appoint someone a bit left field, and that, you know, that might be a woman. So in the context of quotas, I guess, you know, that's a phenomenon at that very senior level, but clearly there's some risk of that sort of decision-making bias coming in and flowing down the stream to you know, other levels in the organisation. So what do you see as, you know, that sort of challenge meaning for quotas, and then how do you mitigate the risk of that? Sort of distilling down the organisation as well. I'd be interested to hear about that.
Okay, I'll try to tackle that. I think what you're describing is quotas without a desire for cultural change. And quotas in of themselves, if there is not a desire for cultural change, will lead to exactly what you're describing. The value of quotas is fast-tracking a desired cultural change. I mean, Jennifer was talking about unconscious biases. So you can have a desire for cultural change, but the unconscious bias might stop anything significant happening. The quota, in my opinion, sort of forces that upon you if you have that desire already as an organisation.
You go first. So one of the things, I've done a bit of reading about what happened in Norway. So Norway introduced a 40% quota for women on boards. Well, actually 40% either. So 40%, 40%, 20%. And what happened there was a bit of a fury about what they called the glass skirt phenomenon, I think. Something like that. golden skirt, that was it. That there'll be a small number of women who were basically on every board. But actually what they found is that what it did is it forced them to think more laterally. I can't just appoint the person I would normally think. I have to think about what is the skill I really need, and how can I find that in a wider group. And so they did end up with a little bit of a golden skirt. There's a bunch of very, very powerful women in Norway now. But they also ended up with a much wider group. And 5 years on, they went back and interviewed a whole lot of people who said, oh, we'll just have terrible women on those boards. You said, oh, yeah, do I say that? Really? It's actually fine. So I mean, I think what they realised was the people they were appointing weren't, they were less experienced in the very narrow thing that they'd been looking at, but they had been more widely experienced. But I have read about your glass cliff phenomenon, and I do believe it's true.
So. Yeah, and maybe in some ways quotas is actually tackling the issue before it becomes an issue, because you're forcing people to do it now rather than until things start to look pear-shaped.
Yeah, I guess a few things come to mind. The first thing is, so some of the research I've read, and it's something that I've seen and I personally believe, is that men tend to be very confident in themselves and in what they're able to do. They'll, if they think they're 60% of the way there, they'll think they're 100% of the way there. Women are the opposite. They might be 90% of the way there, they'll think, oh, but I'm only 30%. And so in some ways it's a little bit surprising to me to sort of hear about that. And I do sort of wonder how much of it is because, well, you put a woman in that role, that doesn't mean you just leave her there and don't talk to her, don't include her as part of the group, you know, don't kind of... I think that inclusion piece is really important, kind of bringing, really having discussions, debating, and kind of, in some ways it's training, maybe it's just kind of getting involved and getting on the same page. You know, I think with any, you introduce a new person to any group, you're going to come across issues like that. You know, you don't just leave somebody there on their own to go, well, do your thing. And I certainly find in my work, in, you know, some of the things that, projects that I've worked on, I think when people have been open to bringing women in or bringing new people in, that's generally worked well. Whether or not I had all the skills to start with, whether or not I had all the knowledge to start with, didn't matter, I could pick it up. You know, I think, but then in situations where people weren't open to it, they just sort of said, okay, well, you have to be here, so be here, then it didn't work well. And, you know, I remember conversations that I had where I sort of said, oh, look, I feel like these people aren't telling me anything. And I remember I was talking to Estelle about it at the time, and she just said, look, when I've come across this in the past, I just sat them down and just said, just show me. I don't want to hear any, you know, any complaints or any sort of anything like that. Just show me. Just do what I'm asking you to do. And in my experience, that's worked well. And it seems a bit surprising to me that if you've hired somebody who, unless they're really grossly underqualified for the role, they can't grow into that role.
So you need to support them.
Yes.
Okay, yep, Michael.
I think a lot of it has to do with the culture in the organisation rather than just a fixed set of quotas, because quotas by themselves won't work, although they will be one of many things you could do simultaneously. But, you know, in the superannuation industry, every conference has a golf day, 90% male. And I mean, our firm is probably guilty as well. We often have clients in on a Friday afternoon to watch rugby. And so you do these things well-intentioned, but the only way that you'll have a balance of activities is if you've got females in your leadership group who are active enough to put forward their own ideas, whether it's staff socialising or clients. Because if you leave it to the men, they won't think about it. They'll think that they're doing the right thing, and they're not malicious, but they won't take a general view. They'll do what they've always done.
Thank you. So I have another question, sorry, from the webinar, about tips for women when they encounter discrimination, or possibly more particularly unconscious bias, and that... research released this week showed that being assertive doesn't actually result in a positive outcome for women, but it does for men. So what else is there in the toolkit? And I guess that's something that, just taking general advice about how do you get ahead in your career, it will not work in the same way for different people. I mean, well, I have views, but I'll ask the panel what they think, if they'd like to comment.
I'm not sure if there's one set of tips, and I think it does depend on the situation you find yourself in. And I guess one of the things I think it's important to recognise is that bias does exist, and it's often not personal. So not take it to heart. And I think that's something I've been guilty of in the past. Yeah. not thinking that it's all about me doing a bad job, that sometimes it is about bias and giving yourself permission to think that. But I have read the same research about assertiveness being, you know, seen differently in men and women, and I think there is some truth to that, and truth whether you're being assertive to a man or to a woman. It's not just about men interpreting it badly, it's also about women interpreting it badly. So it's about, you know, all we need to do is change is society, so that's easy.
Right? Yeah.
So I think it's all about incremental steps and trying to be conscious of ourselves when we're confronted with something, and conscious of ourselves not being biased ourselves, and calling it out when we see it, when we have the power to see it. So that, I mean, that's one of the things that I'm conscious of, you know, as a more senior person. If I see something, I should say something because I have the power to do it. So that's probably the most important thing, that all of us, when we're senior, actually take that action.
Yep, that's great. Yeah, I liked Alistair's actions for us all. And I think that, and I thought, well, a lot of what you said, Alistair, was quite brave in a way, and being able to actually talking about it, because that's exactly what we have to do, is actually have some conversations. And I know that I have been guilty in the past of making assumptions about people and then going, well, why did I make that assumption? And so I think self-awareness is a huge part of it. Now, oh, sorry, Warwick.
Sorry, I'm going to close in a minute. I'm hogging the microphone. There's another point I think worth making, that is we're looking at a level of disruption, particularly in financial service and of innovation, that's going to require a mountain of different solutions than those that currently exist. In my mind, the only way to get to the top of that is with a diverse group of people who will look at this in vastly different ways. And so, for example, I find it rather difficult to understand Facebook and a whole lot of the implications of all of that, and why on earth anybody would do all those things they do on Facebook. But there clearly are a whole lot of others for whom this is just absolutely normal and everyday. And so I think that the issue of diversity is vital for us to attack what we need to attack in the next little while. And gender diversity, of course, is an important part of that.
Okay, thank you. Paul?
Equal pay has been in the news this week and is being reported as, even for the same job, women are paid less than men, and it's described as being a hard problem. I get that it could be expensive, but I don't get why it's hard. Any views?
Equal pay is a difficult one. I think you've got to ask some general questions like, why does society value some occupations as less worthy than others? So nurses, teachers, childcare workers, they probably don't earn as much as an executive assistant in a bank. And you have to say, and many times they're more skilled and the job's harder. But it's a generalisation, but I think society has a lot of those things wrong to start with.
I think it's still being reported that equal jobs are being paid differently. So how come these HR departments that are 95% female let it happen?
First of all, you have to have someone who asks the question. So I was on a board once, and we were looking at pay across a whole lot of different diversities, geographies, type of work that you were doing, whether you're an accountant or an actuary, those kinds of things. Nobody had actually checked what the male-female diversity pay diversity was. So you've got to have the right person to ask the question. And it's probably not the person in HR. It's the person who's in charge. So that's the first point. And I think it increasingly is asked, to be fair. Yeah, that was a while ago. It was in the 2000s. It wasn't in the 1990s. But I guess the second part is that, yeah, it depends how you define exactly the same job. I've seen a lot of very, very narrowly defined jobs, so that you've got the kind of the senior manager in the team doing similar work to the manager in the team, and which one's the man, which one's the woman. It's not, it's, I mean, that'll show as everyone's pay is equal, but it not necessarily is. So I think it's a little bit more complex than just, let's just make sure all of the ratio is exactly 100%.
So I think that that's just the outworking of inequality that exists today. Like, I think, I don't think it's somebody's made the conscious decision, I'm going to pay men more than women. It's really, you know, all this kind of unconscious bias for men are
often seem to be kind of more of a leader, they seem to be perform better, women who are assertive, who are demonstrating all the right things that may be kind of pushing them forward for leadership may not be perceived as well. I think that, you know, quite often men, because they're more confident, they'll be more confident to actually ask for more pay, whereas women, I know I personally would have a lot of difficulty raising anything like pay. I don't think I see as much hesitation on the part of male counterparts, and maybe they know how to have those conversations. I don't know if it's because they've sometimes I wonder if they've all spoken to each other about this and it's something that it's just something that's kind of discussed more openly, who knows. But I think the forces kind of work the other way. It's the people who are asking for the pay who are leading to that effect, and I do think over time, if we, it's one of the measures that I would think, well, if we do achieve equality, that would be one of the kind of key outcomes that we should get.
I agree with Jennifer, this is desperately hard to measure. One thing that we've been working on at ANU, well, in our school at the moment, is the concept, okay, we have an award and everyone gets paid. If you're an associate professor, you get paid the same amount, although there's loadings on top of that, but let's put that aside. There's an expectation that it will take you, let's say, for example, 5 years to get promoted from senior lecturer to associate professor, equivalent full-time. But that means for someone who might be working part-time, that then becomes 8 years or 10 years, depending on how long they're working part-time. So on the surface, it looks like we have equality because everyone at this level receives the same amount. The time taken to be promoted is a lot longer for someone with a break in work. So what we're trying to do at the moment, this is very difficult to make work, is think of promotion in terms relative to opportunity. So you can still be promoted in 5 years, even if you're a 0.6 FTE, if you have demonstrated over that 5 year period that relative to opportunity that you're deserving of promotion. But because of all these variables, it's really, really hard to measure this.
It is, I agree. Okay, Tony, quick question.
Okay, thank you.
Or comment.
Thank comment you. First, whether we saw CEO Energy Australia's speech yesterday, but that was pretty persuasive on this point. What they've done is addressed two big issues. One is same pay for same job, which is, you know, easier, mm-hmm. but they've also tackled the fact that you've got more highly paid men than women in the organisation and how to address that. And finally, a general comment. Policy's good. Appeal to moral imperatives is good, but I like rational self-interest. That is, diversity produces good outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Great thing to finish on. So I'm going to have to close it. I'm sorry. A lot of what I've heard talked about is about culture, which is really important. And I think changing the culture is by having these conversations going to contribute. Self-awareness and all of us actually a little bit of introspection about how we treat other people is valuable, and encouraging others in our organisation. And finally, listening. Last year I heard David Morrison speak 4 times while I was president, and he gave the same speech every time. And he gave us an example when they were trying to improve their gender diversity within the army. They built this great advertising campaign and they did all these great picture ads that they were going to put out there, and they presented it to the staff who went, whoa, this is terrible. It was, you know, women with guns, and, you know, it was never going to appeal to women. And so they said to him, so have you, what did the women think when you showed them? And they went, we haven't asked any women to look at it. All the men in the room had thought they were great advertisements. So talk to women, ask them what they think, and let's move forward from there. But I'd really like you to join me in thanking our panelists, who've all been incredibly interesting. Thank you.